A new headline predicts just how bad artificial intelligence could really be. In fact, it could actually, experts say, lead to the extinction of the human race. Are they totally blowing this out of proportion, or do we have something quite real to worry about? I tend to be a worrier. So I want to dig in and figure out just exactly what the threats are in the tech space overall, certainly when it comes to AI, but also just where we are today, where we're heading, and why is it that no one in Washington, D.C. really seems to care about any of this? Perhaps they just don't understand it. Hello, welcome to the program, everyone. I am Trish Regan. Good to see you back here. I'm very excited to talk with our next guest who just has a tremendous background in intelligence gathering. She herself is quite worried that all of this is being used somehow now internally against American citizens. She's also worried about the future of AI and how other countries, like, say, China, with its TikTok platform, may weaponize and use our data combined with AI against us. We're going to be talking with Kara Frederick from the Heritage Foundation coming up. But a quick mention that portions of the show are brought to you by Legacy Precious Metals, legacypminvestments.com. That is the place where you can go if you want to buy or sell right there online in your own little account, gold or silver. Or you can call them at 1-866-589-0560. Anyway, this is a big deal. Let me share with you some of these headlines just crossing. Artificial intelligence could lead to the extinction of humanity. This is from people that are at Google DeepMind and OpenAI. They are all warning this in a public statement that was published on the Center for AI Safety. Sharing from this, I will quote, "Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war." Anyway, I certainly have my fears about this. All politics aside, when you think about what really could happen, when you think about how some of this technology that's out there that we've used against foreign threats can be used domestically, internally against ourselves. Heck, some of it's already happening. So we need to think through it. According to the Center for AI Safety, AI could be weaponized. For example, drug discovery tools could be used to build chemical weapons. They go on to say misinformation could destabilize society and, quote, undermine collective decision making. Well, I still question what they mean by, quote unquote, misinformation, right? Because that is overwhelmingly now used as a very common term. You just label something misinformation, but it turns out sometimes the people that are giving you the misinformation, I have only to go back to the 51 spies, ex-spies, now political hacks that signed on to that letter Mike Morrell orchestrated that said the whole bit about the Hunter laptop was nothing but a bunch of misinformation from foreign sources designed to affect the election. And of course, we saw the results of that. So my concern is not just misinformation, but information in general. Are we really going to be able to hear from all sides? What's going to happen to primary source material in this new world? Here to talk about all of it, I'm so happy to welcome to the show Kara Frederick. She's head of the Tech Policy Center there at Heritage. Welcome. It is good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I'm going to break it down in a few sections here because, you know, we were watching the stock price of NVIDIA and everybody's super excited because they're like, wow, you know, AI. This is incredible. You look at what's going on at ChatGPT. This is the future, et cetera. People are very optimistic about it. People are very scared as well. And I want to talk to you about both the upside and downside of AI and companies like NVIDIA. But before we get to that, before we do any of that, you have a fascinating background in intelligence. I was joking with you earlier that you were like a super spy, just incredible. Having worked at the NSA, having worked for our military, walk me through sort of how you got into the intelligence gathering space to begin with.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. I was over in London doing my grad degree, and it was somewhat of a boondoggle because I had played soccer in college at the University of Virginia, And there was no women's professional league at the time. So I was like, how do I get in a professional league and still, you know, stay in a different country that'll allow me to play? Oh, get a grad degree. So I was getting my graduate degree and playing for the Women's English Premier League. And I was doing war studies, which was military history had always fascinated me. My dad was in the Marine Corps. So I thought, you know, this is something maybe useful. Maybe I'll go to the State Department or something. And I got an email from a woman very high up in the Defense Intelligence Agency who had previously been a ACC soccer player. She was the head of the counterterrorism division. And we basically did a Skype call, and she said, "You're the exact kind of person I want on my team." And, you know, a few months later, January 2010, I was butt in the seat at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And 6 months after that, I was on a C-17 deployed to Afghanistan.
Oh, my gosh. And so what were you doing in Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I was what you call an all-source analyst. So I was an Al-Qaeda analyst, first and foremost. So we were doing counterterrorism, making sure that the terrorists were kept off the battle space, trying to point the assault force. These were tier-1 special operations forces in the right direction. If these terrorists were in a compound, we were basically giving the full intel picture of, you know, if it was this person. We were finding what we called needles in haystacks, trying to identify them in the whole country, figure out where they were, and then point the guys in the right direction who could do something about it.
Interesting and important, by the way. Like, and it's good that our military is doing this. I guess, you know, a lot of people just start getting worried because it feels as though, it's not the right term to say it feels as though, because I think it definitely has sort of changed from being outward threats to suddenly now there's this inward concern, right? And the military could very easily, I guess, use some of that technology, or it doesn't even have to be military. It could be tech companies using technology reversed on us, on American citizens. And I say that somewhat delicately, but in fact, I think that's really proving to be the case. I mean, they have said that this administration in particular over and over again, that the biggest threat to our country right now is domestic terrorism. All that technology that you were using in Afghanistan, I mean, is it possible in some way, shape or form to turn it on American citizens?
Well, I think especially the Biden administration and the Biden campaign before that, well, when you look at the release of the Twitter files, using, you know, these private companies and their, you know, widgets and gadgets and analytical capacity and personnel to target Americans, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. We wrote about this in February 2022 at the Heritage Foundation, where in a footnote, I hope people read footnotes of our long reports, but in a footnote, we basically consolidated a lot of the public statements that have been made by people close to the Biden campaign at the time, or who had previously worked in Barack Obama administration and are now sort of close to the Biden administration as well, about using these technologies and turning them inward on American citizens. You know, we've seen through Jim Jordan's great work, frankly, and Comer's great work too, the weaponization of our agencies. And, you know, our national intelligence agencies have clearly been weaponized against the American people. Look no further than Mike Morrell, you know, using a CIA email address when it comes to soliciting input from former executives at these national level intelligence agencies to talk about the Hunter Biden laptop and call it, have all the earmarks of Russian disinformation. So
that was amazing to me, by the way. I'm just going to say, to think that you could have 51. I mean, frankly, there, as far as I'm concerned, just a whole bunch of political hacks, because there should have been some allegiance to what was really going on and knowing the truth before you sign your name to a document insisting that something is misinformation, when in fact the FBI was investigating it at the time. I mean, that's just wild to me. By the way, same people like Brennan were out there saying that dossier proved that Trump was a Russian operative, and it turned out that was nothing but a bunch of opposition research and therefore misinformation. So it's like everything is backwards, and you wonder why the American people are sitting there saying, well, who do I trust? They don't have any faith in any institution anymore, Because, well, why should they when stuff like that happens? Is this something new in your view, Kara, or has this kind of always gone on and maybe just it's getting exposed more now?
So, I'm a millennial, a geriatric millennial, but I grew up completely credulous, you know, sort of bleeding red, white, and blue, thinking that our federal bureaucracy or our agencies...
Well, your dad was a Marine.
My dad was a Marine for over 30 years, and this is what, you know, I thought that the best people devoted themselves to the service of the country, and, you know, there's no way that they would consider their fellow citizens the enemy, or frankly, worse than Al-Qaeda, like we were hunting in Afghanistan. And, you know, these weren't just, you know, regular, like, Taliban guys or anything like that. These were Al-Qaeda operatives at the top of the food chain, those engaging in external operations, so looking to conduct attacks against the United States. So I just thought that, you know, everybody was sort of rowing in the same direction, and we all wanted the same thing. And that was...
I thought that too, going into journalism.
Yes. So I do think this is new. I'd never seen the like in my lifetime, at least. You know, we know with the Church Committee decades ago that there were some problems with a lot of these agencies, and you know, those should be ferreted out. But especially post 9/11, the people who went into the service, the military services, that worked at these national level intelligence agencies, we were the true believers. We were very ardent when it came to the mission. We would always say, "It's the mission. It's the mission. It's the mission." And now it appears it's politics, politics, politics. When you
That's
look at
the mission.
FBI, yeah, exactly, exactly. So I think, it, especially at the technical level, like you mentioned, it's particularly destructive when you have Americans calling on drone strikes for their fellow Americans. This is post January 6th, and, you know, saying in public, "Yes, we should target these people like we target actual legitimate foreign Islamist terrorists." That is extremely problematic, and it's extremely problematic then when the Biden administration's DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, issues terrorism warnings that say things like they did in February of 2022, that spreading disinformation about COVID was tantamount to terrorist activity. So we've seen this slow definition inflation of domestic terrorism, of extremism, to encompass mainstream American thought with a conservative bent and start to sort of turn these apparatuses inward on Americans. So
it's happened before. Like, let's not kid ourselves. I mean, that's, you know, we saw it in the 60s. I was watching Trumbo the other day. I told the viewers that this can happen, and it can happen on either side. I mean, which is why you want government effectively on that short leash, if that makes sense, right? The smaller government that doesn't get big and bloated and then suddenly wants to be all powerful and controlling everything. But when you think about the advances in modern technology, and specifically within tech and within social media, and you combine that with, and by the way, the commercial interests of all that, right? And you combine that with government interests that, you know, well, I guess it's fair to say most tech executives tend to lean left as opposed to right. I worry that that is actually going to put America in a very, and already has, in a very dangerous spot. You used to work at Facebook as well, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You got it all covered. So, I mean, when you started at Facebook, was it sort of more coming out of, you know, you were at NSA, you were at the Defense Department. What was the change? How did that experience apply to what you're doing at Facebook?
Yeah, so I spent a few years as a DIA embed at the National Security Agency, with, you know, full accesses to all their systems, doing a lot of the signals intelligence work. And when it came to what was happening in the geopolitical milieu at the time, it was basically when ISIS, they had, you know, arisen from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they became this this force, really, and this very notable public force when it came to, hey, we want a caliphate, we want actual territory, we're going to attack you everywhere, but we're also going to have sort of a homeland of our own. And they were advertising and recruiting online. What people used to say is they were slick propagandists. You know, they were putting out videos. If you guys remember James Foley, a former journalist who was
From New Hampshire, by the way, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was that kind of thing to really get our blood boiling. They burned alive a Jordanian pilot as well. They filmed, drowning people in cages. And it was really the brutality that was shocking and would go viral. So they were using these commercial platforms to recruit, to terrify people, and to effectively act as what they were, terrorists. So Facebook realized that some of the commercial actors realized that this was happening, and they wanted to make their platforms hostile to terrorist actors. So they started to look in at some of these agencies. Who are the people who have been doing this for a long time? What is the muscle memory that's there? How can they help professionalize our own experience in expunging these bad actors off of these platforms? So, and you know, a big recruiting glut, they brought a bunch of us over. I was working for a Naval Special Warfare Command at the time, went over to Facebook in California, and found some, you know, it, there was a lot of
talent. There must have been a big change.
It was a big change. It was, you know, Kara coming over, bleeding red, white, and blue, singing yeah.
Suddenly in Palo Alto.
Yeah, and wearing their sneakers and their jeans, which we kind of did a little bit at Fort Meade, but it was still, it was a big, big culture shock. And I think for me, not in the way that, oh, you know, all these kids and their lattes and, you know, walking around talking about things that didn't necessarily pertain to the next deployment, but it was more like, there was a lack of what I call a geopolitical cognition throughout the building. So our little team, our global security team, was very focused on this kind of thing. But everyone else kind of, you know, they thought that they were the center of power in the universe. They thought that they were the ones doing all the big things. And in a lot of ways, they were and still are. But they didn't really care about the politics in D.C. You know, their thing was, yeah, we pretty much do what we want. We ship it. We deploy these products. And then we kind of ask for forgiveness later.
But in some ways, like not caring about the politics in D.C., like that is what made Facebook. You know, and it's good that they brought you and others in to look at international threats. But that was sort of the beauty of the place initially, right? That, you know, nobody was sitting there saying you can say this, you can't say that. I mean, the fact that they didn't care about politics in some ways, I think that's what attracted people to the platform initially, but it's changed.
Yeah, that, and that's a fantastic point. And I will say a lot of these founders too, they have more of a libertarian bent where they're just the doers. We're the builders. We're create. We are engineers in their purest form. We solve problems. And they sort of took that, created their companies. And then I would say everything else caught up to them, right? You might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you.
Sure.
And we've seen that happen, in Silicon Valley, much to the detriment of conservatives and people with conservative opinions, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I understand that. So what was the switch? Like, was it 2016? Was it the shocker that Donald Trump won? Was it the panic that maybe Russia bought up some Facebook accounts? Or, you know, I mean, what is it that suddenly, all of a sudden, Facebook went from being like, you could just talk about politics pretty openly to, wow, you know, if you are following that person, maybe you are a security threat to the United States of America?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I had the pleasure or not of really witnessing the shift, because I was there pre-2016 Trump election and post-2016 Trump election.
Okay.
So I might be a little biased in terms of the time frame that was most immediate to me. But what I did witness was a focus on good priorities, noble priorities initially. So foreign Islamic terrorism, making sure that was off the platform. Child sexual abuse material, making sure that was off the platform. Those, especially the CSAM, the child sexual abuse material teams and engineers, that was a very robust operation. And they were, I think, doing a lot of good work there. But then when Trump got elected, I mean, I was actually in the office at night, West Coast time, watching it happen. And nobody else was really there, but coming in the next morning, it was a different place. It was, and palpably, oh yeah, people were very, very concerned about the direction of the country. And afterwards, with the media pillaring Zuckerberg and, you know, the leadership of Facebook and Facebook as a platform itself, and saying that, you know, they helped Trump get elected because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. I think a lot of the leadership and middle management took that very seriously. And changed the whole tenor of the place after that. But I will say that it had been percolating a little bit beforehand. There were people saying that we shouldn't be so focused on foreign Islamist extremism. There might be some bias there, so we have to focus on white supremacy and alt-right and right-wing thoughts and, you know, getting the frogs off kind of thing. So that was definitely an undercurrent, but it really just exploded, I would say, post-2016 and post-Cambridge Analytica
news. Sure. No, and then you fast forward to today, and my gosh, like, we're all bracing for 2024. It's like, what can you say, what can you not say? And just trying to kind of keep tabs on, like, where we are, right? Like, what's forbidden? And we know, like, I still say March 2020, that's code for what we all know happened in March 2020. Because if the algorithm picks up the word, suddenly, boom. I mean, that kind of stuff is wild to me. Or even, I have friends that were talking about, I was one of them, I didn't get hit with this. But the, you know, you're in the penalty box, or you're getting the fake news notice because you mentioned that it happened to be a recession when we did have 2 quarters of negative growth quite recently during the Biden administration. And everybody's like, no. Listen, if that were Trump, everybody would be like, see, textbook definition. I actually pulled out a textbook. My uncle was an economics professor, wrote one of the most used textbooks in the country. And I pulled it out. And I'm like, look, what do you think? 2 consecutive quarters of negative growth. But I know, you know, until Biden's team officially calls it, we can't actually say it. You know where I'm going. So in other words, it's like, at what point does it stop? And like, how do you actually protect the freedom of this country, our constitutional rights, our First Amendment? How do you protect that in light of there being this bias from tech and this political bias simultaneously? And by the way, they work together. Vivek Ramaswamy has written on this in a really interesting way with Woke Inc. about how they're all kind of, you know, greasing each other's palms, so to speak, because one hand feeds the other. And it's like everybody's embedded with this common interest that leaves a lot of Americans, frankly, half the country behind.
Yeah. And, you know, we used to say that we were sort of building an airplane in mid-flight. And now it looks like that, you know, they're making policy decisions and then retrofitting the justifications later. And we've seen that happen again and again and again. And the thing is, they're making it up as they go along. And if there is a particular political bent, which clearly we've seen there is, the errors, quote unquote, like Vivek's LinkedIn account was just locked. The errors.
I'm waiting for mine. I'm like,
yeah. They go in one direction. And like you said, there's a symbiosis between a lot of these government entities, between these commercial entities as well. You're seeing a lot of the misinformation policies encompass what I call the central tenets of the Biden administration, that climate change is the most immediate national security threat and the worst thing ever. Gender ideology, you can change your gender no matter how young you are. And on and on and on. We all know right now what they believe and what is not permitted to be on these platforms. That's so crazy. I think the way that you help, attempt to return to some degree of normalcy. And I don't think, I will say, I don't think that neutrality is going to be reclaimed or recaptured on these platforms. I think the only hope is we sort of stem the tide. We stay on these platforms to not cede the territory. And as we continue to buy time to build our own, which, you know, a lot of those efforts aren't going very well because network effects are real and prime mover advantage is real.
That's an interesting point you bring up right there. And again, we're talking with Kara Frederick, who is the director of the Tech Policy Center at Heritage Foundation, just has a tremendous background in intelligence and in social media, having been at Facebook. So just a fascinating conversation if you're just tuning in right now. Kara, when you think about the landscape as we move forward and we look into AI and, you know, who's the first mover there and what kind of advantage does one have, I want to get to that. But I also think it's critical to talk about what you just mentioned, building, quote unquote, our own platforms. And I hate to say our own. I really hate to use it because, look, I'm still a registered independent. I'm willing to vote for JFK, cut taxes. I like to point that out. I'm willing to vote for anybody who comes up with the most solid economic plan, the most solid, you know, plan for protecting our country. I hate to be motivated entirely by politics or by party. I feel like something like economics and you know, military protection should be universal, but I'll leave that aside. I just think that there has to be a place where people can go where they can get the other side. So if Google's the main search engine, what becomes the counter to that? Because look, we know these biases. So where can people go to get something different? Do conservatives need to build that as a separate thing, like a separate pipeline? I spoke with somebody recently who had a very interesting idea, even almost establishing like a different economy. It was wild. They actually used examples like post-Civil War America and the challenges that Black Americans had integrating into the rest of the economy. And so they said, you know, to heck with it, we're building our own. And then Israel and the challenges Israel had initially. And they said, you know what, we can do this ourselves. And they helped each other. And they just were able to really become successful and phenomenal in their own right. And so some people have said, maybe there needs to be an infrastructure that assists conservatives in a similar way. Could we do that on a tech front?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are trying. You look at Martin Avila with Rightforge. He's trying to create a cloud infrastructure, because we know when Parler was kicked off of Apple and Google, their app stores, that mattered a lot. But when it came to Amazon Web Services actually kicking Parler off, that was the biggest problem. We needed a cloud hosting service, or at least somebody in neutral needed a cloud hosting service that wasn't going to say, oh, yeah, you know, people are screaming for Parler's head, so let's give it to them, sort of unjustifiably, as mm-hmm. it turns out, given the research coming out after 2021. So I absolutely think that we have to, you know, embrace the entirety of the digital stack and build accordingly, which means digital platforms. It means digital services like email delivery services, like payment processors that are online, like frankly, even maybe internet service providers need to start rethinking things as well. Of course, the cloud hosting service infrastructure needs to be, you know, as neutral as possible. So yes, I think we have to build. The biggest thing that we're seeing, there's a big cryptocurrency Bitcoin debate when it comes to central digital currencies, because when you consolidate and concentrate power and centralize it in a newly digitized world, then you can basically control what all of the minions can do. So I think
and China's trying to do it, right? They have their digital yuan, and they can. It's amazing, because you can, when you want to help a specific group or specific economy, you can just flood them with digital yuan. You know exactly where they're spending money. That whole social mm-hmm. credit score comes in on steroids, because suddenly the government has the ability to, you know, get in there and monitor your bank account. And people say, okay, like, this is, you know, this is science fiction. And I'm like, Kara, think about what Janet Yellen was saying. They wanted to be able to look at your bank account if you had so much as $600 in there. I'm like, you guys are not going after the billionaires here. If you've had $600 in transactions, there was the need for the government, for the IRS, to be able to go in and look at your bank account. I'm sorry, but this is, I mean, it could happen.
Oh, it's here. It's here. Look at the trucker convoy in Canada. You know, Justin Trudeau turned off their ability to withdraw money because it was digitized. So, yeah, I don't think that America is immune from that kind of threat whatsoever, especially when you have Biden and his Office of Science and Technology Policy saying, hey, centralized, you know, digital bank currencies, here are some things to think about, hint, hint, kind of thing. So, I think it's very worrisome that our government tends to or appears to be moving in that direction. And I think we have to do everything we can to stop it. And that includes building, you know, that includes having digital services of our own.
So is Elon Musk, do you think, helpful to the cause in that sense with Twitter?
I do, but I don't think that we can depend on another white knight billionaire. And I don't think we should have to either. So I think he's a singular man. He met a singular moment. And I don't think that's a repeatable strategy necessarily. I would love
not everybody. Not everybody has nearly $50 billion to spend, for which he probably overspent by, you know, some 35 billion. Yeah. You know, I hear you. And so, you know, having, but it gets back to a lot of different things, right? In terms of our youth and making sure you said you grew up red, white, and blue. I did too. And by the way, yeah. I grew up in a place where you could have very different political opinions. We mattered once every 4 years there in little old New Hampshire because we, you know, we hosted the first in the nation primary. But it was very, like, everybody had bumper stickers on their car for whatever candidate. Everybody had different views. And it was like, the joke was, you know, one farmer says to another, well, who are you going to vote for? And the other farmer says, well, I don't know. I've only met each of the candidates three times. I mean, they were, you know, that's, they're into it. But you could have normal discussion and normal discord, right? And still be best friends with someone. And so we've totally lost that. And I just think it has to change. And so culturally, whatever we can do with our youth to make them more accepting, to make them more compassionate and more empathetic to different views is critical. So knowing all that we just heard from you, let's now layer in this even more complicated issue, which is just the massive rate at which technology is improving almost in a scary way. Like, there are people that are afraid of robots. Like, I've known some. In fact, one of my kids, like, she would watch the Jetsons and be kind of freaked out by Rosie the robot. And I look back on it, I'm like, you know what? She was onto something. Because when you think about what computers actually can do going forward and how they can mimic people, and it's wild. You've told me off air some of the things that AI might be able to do, especially when combined with all the data they've been gathering on TikTok or Facebook or anywhere else. Walk us through your concerns.
Yeah, so, you know, traditionally, a lot of AI systems, we call them very narrow systems, very brittle systems. So they can conduct tasks or do what they're programmed to do. So nothing really to be afraid of. These learning systems, in particular, an application of AI machine learning, this is where the machines tend to learn from the data and they develop solutions to problems. And that's when I think everybody's kind of getting a little nervous. So we know that AI, people use AI on their phones. There are certain things that are very, very, again, very narrow, very simple, and they're useful. It helps sort of not even supercharge, but just enhance your ability to conduct everyday tasks. Like, AI can analyze data, it can find patterns, it can predict trends, it can automate certain tasks. But now it looks like these, what everyone is calling AGI, artificial general intelligence. So these general systems, some people say it's not a thing, that never going to happen. Others say it's 5-10 years down the road. This is where these systems, AI, in fact, apply their expertise more broadly. So people are very concerned about, frankly, a human being out of the loop. We always say humans must be in the loop. So a human must factor in the decision making of these machines. It's when human beings are, you know, hands are off the wheel and these machines are, say, fully autonomous in a military application sense and making their own decisions, that's problematic. There are a lot of, especially military and defense applications of AI that we're already seeing that I frankly worked with in the field, like semi-autonomous weapons or drones. I work with Predators, I work with Reapers, MQ-1s, MQ-9s. So, you know, these things have been in the field for a very long time, but it's the development of more sophisticated systems that apply their expertise more generally, that's the fear. A good example that my old boss, he would use is, human beings can bend down to tie their shoe and look over and grab an apple and then jump in the car and operate the car. Machines haven't been able to do that. That's very flexible and sophisticated intelligence. Machines are basically much more narrow with their expertise confined to a single domain. They can say, given a series of images, that's a cat, that's a rat, that's a dog kind of thing. And it's when they start to gain that expertise that they can apply to doing things like tying a shoe, grabbing an apple, and then operating a vehicle, that's when it becomes problematic. We're not there yet, but we are heading in that direction, I think a lot of AI researchers would say.
Some people worry about this hallucination, so to speak, that AI has, where it will just start generating false quotes and go off like on some tangent and present it as though it's entirely real. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so these are problems with some of the large language models. So it's more commonly referred referred to ChatGPT is probably the most famous one to date, GPT-4 or so it's called. Mm-hmm. This is what OpenAI has been working on for, frankly, years. If you'll remember, back in 2019, GPT-2 was released and they open sourced the code to that under the tenets of, you know, the reason why OpenAI was created in the mm-hmm. first place, to open source a lot of this code so that all of these programmers could look at it, help refine those algorithms, and basically be more transparent when it came to this really transformative technology. Now they're sort of closing that off a lot more. And when they do that, we can't necessarily understand why these machines are making the mistakes that they're making. And as you said, they are prone to error. They are prone to mistakes. And there's tons of categories of these mistakes at that. If you'll remember some of the original AI conversations that we were having in 2018, 2019, centering around machines beating humans at games like Go, Watson and Jeopardy.
I remember when that Garry Kasparov, right, was playing at chess against the computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the course of these games, while the machines are faring very, very well, because again, they can take these large reams of data and parse through it and identify patterns and anomalies, and in this case, the right answer, that they're very good at that, but they're also prone to these insanely exaggerated mistakes that humans probably wouldn't make, like in the case of IBM, Watson, and Jeopardy. Can answer very intense questions, but he stumbles at some of the most basic questions that a human being would take for granted. So they are absolutely prone to error. Some of the errors within GPT-4 could be as a result of that, the bias of their safety layer, which we've talked about in the conservative circles a lot.
Bias is concerning because, you know how they say, you know, history is written by those that, you know, are the victors, so to speak, right? And so everything is looked at historically. It's why I'm just such a big believer in primary source material to this day. Like, I get so excited when I walk into a library. I love libraries. I'm like, all right. And you want, I still like to go back, you know, the old microfiche. You probably don't know because I'm sure I'm that much older than you, but like, you used to be able to go in the library and like look at the old newspapers there on the film. Yes. And like, I love it. Like, I think it's so cool. And being able to actually see things, right, like as they were in that time, as opposed to relying on some database somewhere to feed you all these articles. So we're getting increasingly away from that, and we're not going to have as much represented from the people that were squashed, so to speak, by these algorithms. And so I think that's the question going forward. I mean, are you only allowed to think one way, the way the AI bots want you to think, whatever they say is ultimately, you know, the way things go? I've already experimented a little bit with it. It's very clear, like, there is a bias, there is a liberal bias. And, you know, like things like CRT, which I think should be fairly questioned, especially when you think about who our country is and what we want it to be in terms of equal opportunity and aspiration and all of these things. The idea that like somebody's just born at a disadvantage because of their color, their skin. I mean, I really fundamentally have problems with it, but ChatGPT is going to tell me, you know, this is it.
And I think what's key to remember for your viewers and listeners to remember is that there's always a human being behind the design of the code. So these programmers are actually, you know, they're making decisions when they're coding these algorithms. They're making specific decisions and value judgments when they are designing these products and these for a lot of commercial use too. And, you know, it's not just that. It's also that, like I talked about, David Sachs, an entrepreneur, you know, one of the PayPal mafia guys, he's great on this in terms of what that safety layer looks like. You know, you have your larger language model, and what sits upon that is the safety layer, which human beings are sort of saying, oh, this could be harmful information. We can't, you know, necessarily emphasize that. And so they're sort of imputing their own bias into the system, which itself is subject to technical forms of bias, which is any deviation from a standard. So you're looking at biases on top of biases. And then by the time that the outputs are getting to the user, they're tainted, frankly. Sure. And when they're tainted in one direction, kids using this for learning, they're only going to see a specific I would say side of the information. They're not going to be able to use their own critical thinking skills, like you said, after perusing through primary sources. Yes. And we've lost it.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary. I just want to add into this TikTok, and given your experience in intelligence gathering, given your experience on that global stage, what would be your worry with a company like TikTok, the data that it's gathering on U.S. citizens? What's your fear, sort of worst case scenario as we move forward?
Yeah, my worst case scenario, my fear is the integration of data. We know from, you know, a lot of the smart China watchers out there that China gets as much data as it can, and then it figures out what to do with it later when, you know, technological developments catch up. Great examples of these are the OPM data breach, you know, a series of data breaches, including OPM, Equifax, financial information, Anthem, healthcare information, Marriott, hotel and travel information on American citizens, all of this pilfered by China. And when they can integrate those data sets, add to it TikTok data and the patterns of life, the unique device identifiers of your physical device that TikTok scoops up, access to your clipboard that TikTok scoops up, microphone access so they can help figure out voice recognition, biometric information like your face, take all of those data sets, integrate them together, pass AI over it, use this new technology in order to identify those patterns, detect those anomalies. They're picking out individual Americans in that scenario for a potential creation of intelligence pictures, for potential espionage, for blackmail. I mean, if you don't want your son or daughter to have a full digital profile sitting in the storage, you know, the data centers, the CCP, then you can't let your kids be on TikTok.
I absolutely full on agree. Want to ask you about this because it's overwhelming for me. Understandably, I mean, I can barely work my microwave, right? So it's very overwhelming for me. I'm sure, you know, you're taking precautions, but it's still, it's a lot coming in. What about our lawmakers? I mean, what are they doing to secure and protect us? Because I know if it's tough for me, like the average age keeps getting up there, let's be honest, in Washington, D.C., like they're definitely not getting it. Like, how do we make sure that government stays, you know, I was going to say five steps, but I'll take a step ahead of where this is all going.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're not there yet. We're not even close to there yet. You know, we're probably 12 years behind what's going on. And, you know, I've told you sort of technology always outpaces attempts to govern it. That's sort of the reality of the, I'll call it a cat and mouse game in this instance. So we are, when we can't figure out a way to tell the American public that TikTok is a national security threat, not to mention what it's doing to the minds and brains of our children before they're fully formulated, then we have a massive problem. You said, what are they doing? It appears to be not much. They could do a lot more. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's part of my job too, is to let them know about these risks, to give them the best recommendations possible, to, you know, at bare minimum, let's have some sort of national data protection framework that prevents these third parties from hoovering up a lot of the data that, you know, you're not very fully aware of what you're agreeing to when you go on these even U.S. commercial platforms. There's no transparency when it comes to plain English of what you're giving up when you're downloading these products and using them on a regular basis. So I think it starts with that. It starts with Americans deserving to know how their data is stored, collected, and shared, and proper limitations on that kind of thing.
For sure. Because otherwise we're hugely at risk. So keep up the good work. Stay on them. I'll stay on them too in my own way. But I think also there's an obligation of all of us as individuals to take precautions. And I would just say to any parent out there, whatever, you know, keep your kids off the stuff, because the algorithms are extraordinarily dangerous in and of themselves in terms of what they're feeding these kids. And then on top of that, the digital footprint that will last forever for your child. I mean, it's a kind of DNA, right? Look into their lives, and you don't want that. So we've got to keep our kids safe. Anyway, Kara, it is wonderful to see you. Thank you for all your time today. We so appreciate you joining.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And they can read more of your work, right? You said you came out in 2022 with a piece there at Heritage. You can go to heritage.org and read some of Kara's work and hopefully get some even more expertise on all of this. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Trish.
So lots of ideas there on how to protect yourself keep everything as private as you possibly can. And I guess keep the kids offline, right? When you think about protecting yourself, it's not just how do you protect yourself online? How do you protect your money and keep it safe? I think it's a real valid concern, given what we just heard from Kara on digital currency. It's perhaps why some of you still like the good old fashioned stuff, right? Which happens to be our show sponsor. I'm talking about Legacy Precious Metals. LegacyPMInvestments.com is their website. If you're interested in investing in gold or silver, by the way, silver's much cheaper, of course. Gold is still, wow, it's just really been on a tear this year. Whether or not that continues, of course, I think is one of the big questions, but we're looking at $2,000 nearly an ounce right now, $1,995 there on the gold continuous contract. You can find all that information actually at LegacyPMInvestments.com. You can buy gold there. You can buy gold coins, or you can just buy, a sliver of this stuff. They have all kinds of different things, even the big gold bars. You can put it in a gold vault or have it sent to your home. Call them at 1-866-589-0560 or go to their website, LegacyPMInvestments.com. Today, you can open up your own account. Imagine that. I guess there's a lot to be fearful of for some reason in the future. I don't think any of this is very encouraging, but I think these are conversations that need to be had and we need to keep having them because this is critical stuff. So I encourage you to make sure that you have subscribed to the channel if you haven't already. Make sure that you're following the podcast on Apple Podcasts. If you haven't done that, please go over and do that as well. It is wonderful to have you all here. Such important times. We've got to keep discussing all this. Make sure if you haven't already on the YouTube channel, subscribe and hit the bell. The bell is critical because the bell is what tells you when I'm here and when I'm live. And you know how much I love hearing from all of you there in the live chat. We'll keep talking. Have a wonderful afternoon. Talk tomorrow.